Good morning and welcome to our virtual meeting. It's 9 a.m. on May 18th, 2021, and time to convene a regular meeting of the Snohomish County PUD Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. In accordance with the Governor's Proclamation 20-28.15, we are holding meetings remotely. Online with us, we have Commissioner Rebecca Wolf, Commissioner Tony Olson, John Harlow, our CEO General Manager, Ann Spangler, our General Counsel, Melissa Collins, our Commission Executive Services Director, Allison Morrison, our Assistant Clerk of the Board, and Jenny Rich, Deputy Clerk of the Board. The written record will indicate others who are present. Please mute and turn off the camera on your devices when not speaking. This session is for the Board and CEO General Manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves with PUD staff. If there is a public request to comment and time remains, 15 minutes will be allowed at the end of the briefing session. So first up, we have our General Manager's briefing and study session. Good morning, John.
Good morning, commissioners. We've got lots of good stuff to go over this morning, so we'll get right to it. First up is Laura Zorich with our community engagement update. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. So we had a couple of fun interviews that occurred in this past month. Stanwood High School have reached out, and we don't generally in our education department have much that goes towards the high school portion, which I know that they're working on right now. So it was really fun to get to help facilitate their desire to interview a couple of PUD employees. They had basically a week of PUD interviews where they asked us a bunch of great questions. The interviewees were kind of specific to what they were hoping. This is Stanwood High School, so they have had sustained outages and things like that. So they really wanted someone who was talking about how we handle and manage the system as a whole. So we had Jeannie Harshberger talk about, you know, some of the questions they asked her were, what does this mean? What do you plan and protect? What does that even mean? Some fun things about, you know, what's the purpose of the PUD? Even to what was your favorite fruit? Because they're still trying to keep it a little bit high level and fun and entertaining for the students as well. So Jeannie was the first day. I filled in on the second, then Don Pressler, Julie Mainstone, and Colleen Murphy. So it was a wide range of different employees that just happened to all be females, which was kind of neat to be able to offer as well. And then I have followed up with them about additional interviews that they might want, but would love to make this kind of a regular thing. You know, they just really had a lot of questions about what skills should they develop to be successful in their careers and their next step into college and or the trade. So really wanted to bring in Julie to talk through some of her interactions with the trades and how we can support that as well and the benefits of going into that field.
But yeah, wonderful.
It was a lot of fun. And they are recorded. I did not want to subject any of you guys to that. So certainly happy to provide those if needed. But
Laura, did any of them say that their favorite fruit was a currant?
No, no. So they asked us what our favorite fruit
was.
I got that question. You know, I talk way too much, so I probably took up way too many of their the time. But they didn't get to ask me my favorite fruit. I'm sure that they asked it to everyone else, but yeah.
This is Commissioner Olson. I'm very pleased to hear that included in that was information and possible outreach to those that might be interested in taking the trade path
very
for
much
future.
So.
And I know that we've received previous briefings on there's going to be a more concerted effort to do that. So this is another way of introducing them to the utility.
I think Julie was just crucial to kind of bring in. I would love to bring in maybe with the following meetings. It just didn't really work up or interviews.
Yeah,
it didn't
yeah.
work with schedules and things. So hoping that we can do this, not just with Stanwood, but all the other high schools. It just was a lot of fun and really a great way for us to provide. Who knew what we do with the utility? And I think it's surprising at times when people do look in and see the variety of jobs that we do have and paths that they can take into the utility as well.
Did you explain that the governance is done by elected commissioners?
Yes, and I think that they would be interested in speaking with you guys at some point as well. Yeah. And that's just something else to kind of consider and think through. I think as many different varieties of positions that we can kind of showcase, even though it's terrible to watch myself speak on the video, it's just nice to know that we have that if somebody else would be interested in hearing about the variety of jobs that we do offer and do have. I'm, yeah, astounded at times when I hear all of the variety of positions and skill sets that we have at the PUD.
Well, thank you, Laura. I'm glad we jumped on that opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you, Laura. Next up is for questions on the legislative update that was provided in the packet. And Clark is available if you have any questions. Good morning, Clark.
Any questions, Commissioner?
Yeah, this is Commissioner Wolf. What was the part that the governor vetoed in, I was just reading the partial veto of House Bill 1091. What was it? Let's see. It says the governor signed into law the clean fuel standard, but he vetoed. What was the part that he vetoed? What would that have done?
Yeah, good morning, commissioners. So in House Bill 1091, this is the clean fuel standard.
Right.
The partial veto that the governor signed was more or less the connection to the transportation package. So there was that provision that was in both 5126, the Climate Commitment Act, mm-hmm. and the Clean Fuel Standard that connected the enactment or the actual, like, the passage of, the enactment of those bills on the passage of a transportation package with that 5 cent or more gasoline tax increase. So that's the part that was struck out. So there's that connection is no longer direct between those two.
Okay, thanks.
Any other questions for Clark?
There's a good article in the Herald today, and the title is Inslee Signs Ambitious Environmental Protection Laws.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Clark. Next up, we're gonna have Kevin Johnston give us an informational cyber security briefing and in large part specific to the Colonial Incident breach. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, John. Good morning, commissioners. As John said, Kevin Johnston, I've addressed the commission a couple times now. I'm the cybersecurity architect for the district and was invited out this morning to deliver some informational comments and provide some context on the Colonial briefing or the Colonial attack, just to kind of describe what occurred and what the implications might be for us moving forward, and more importantly, what our protections are currently to prevent to a maximum extent this type of attack occurring against the district. So, so on May 7th, the Colonial Pipeline, which was a major East Coast gasoline, diesel, jet fuel pipeline, suffered a ransomware attack against their corporate system. So it's important to note that there's a difference between the corporate information technology systems and the operational technology systems, which govern the flow of in this case, gasoline and other petroleum products through the pipeline. In our case, this would be the difference between our corporate IT systems, which we use, on the information technology side, versus the OT SCADA type systems that we use to govern electrical and water distribution. So in this case, the ransomware attack occurred against the Colonial Pipeline information technology systems. And as a result, they made a decision to voluntarily or precautionarily disconnect their operational technology systems from the internet and to take down that part of their infrastructure, presumably to prevent the spread of, in this case, the ransomware encryption portion, so the part of the ransomware that actually encrypts traffic and locks down the network. The they made the choice to take down their operational technology network to have to prevent that from becoming encrypted and unusable in the future. It's a couple days later, according to open source media, they did pay the ransom to the ransomware, what they call a ransomware crew. In this case, it's a criminal operation known as DarkSide, presumably based in Eastern Europe, most likely the Russia or the former Soviet Union nations. So they paid $5 million, which was paid in 76 Bitcoin. So once again, we see the influence of cryptocurrency making ransomware a little easier for criminal organizations to conduct and do so behind the cover of cryptocurrencies. But I think that the other thing that's notable here is they also made off, they being the DarkSide ransomware group, made off with 100 gigabytes, so quite a lot of corporate data. And the concern there not only is that it can be used, to spread sensitive information, around the internet, things like identity theft and such, but also that it contains information related to the operation of their networks or vendor networks or networks of peers that they would otherwise be interconnected with. So it's an opportunity then for the attackers to gain intelligence on which might be used in the pursuance of more attacks against similar vendors or similar providers. So starting from a real high level, ransomware, we hear the term quite a bit. And generally, it's malicious software that prevents a user from accessing their computer until some sort of ransom is paid, right? And in this case, and in most cases, it's cryptographic based. So in this case, the ransomware entered the colonial corporate IT environment via an unknown method. But if one were to just take a guess, it's most likely due to phishing, which we talk about often, right, as being the number one threat associated with malware or other types of cybersecurity attacks, or a potentially improperly maintained or improperly configured internet-facing device. But regardless, once the malware gets into the corporate IT environment, it spreads very quickly. And in this case, it went through and encrypted pretty much the entirety of the colonial IT network. And by encrypting it, it locks it down and prevents the user or even administrators from being able to use, maintain, access, those systems, to include things like network infrastructure such as firewalls, switches, those types of things. So the entire network becomes, in our cybersecurity terms, bricked, right? Because those devices are nothing more than a paperweight at that point, right? They can't be used for anything. So in a ransomware attack, ideally, if you were the criminal, right, ideally the victim pays the ransom, and then at that point the decrypting technology is released to allow the network to be restored. That is not the FBI and other federal government organizations do not advise paying ransoms to these organizations, because it encourages the furtherance of this type of criminal activity, right? So from a victim's perspective, it puts the victim of a ransomware attack in kind of a it's a forced decision at that point. If the network and the data is unusable, and you're not willing to pay the ransom due to any number of reasons, maybe you can't afford it, maybe you find it morally objectionable, et cetera, the ransom is not paid, you essentially cannot use that hardware or access that data. So you're forced to rebuild your network, ideally from backups, but also could just be a complete removal and replacement of everything associated with technology on that network. So it becomes a big infrastructure project to rebuild from these ransomware attacks. Interestingly enough, when Colonial paid the ransom in this case, the decrypting tool was provided, but it was so slow that they were forced to actually rebuild their network anyway, right? So they paid the $5 million, they got the tool from the criminal operation, but it would have taken so long to decrypt the network that they made the decision based on operational efficiency to stop using the decryption tool and just rebuild their network from backups. So they essentially paid the fight, and this is according to what's been reported in open source media anyway, that they paid the $5 million and essentially got no usable benefit from it. So that is the just kind of addressing ransomware in general. If there is a bright side to any of these, you know, whether it's the Colonial attack or any other attack that we've seen, is that we in the cybersecurity community can learn and do learn from these types of events, right? So every time one of these happens, we have an opportunity to have a look at what were the technical underpinnings, what were the decisions of leadership, how did that affect policy? And you saw the Biden administration react with an executive order to provide more strength in cybersecurity reporting across both public and private enterprises. So we'll see how that develops. We'll see how that turns into actionable law. But at least right now, it's a statement of intent, and it's a statement of resourcing across the federal government to provide more focus on cybersecurity defense. And I think that it is notable that they're focusing on defense rather than just proliferation of cybersecurity technologies or even taking offensive cybersecurity type of operations. So offensive hacking to the enemy organizations. This order is very much focused on we need to defend the critical infrastructure and technology and networks of the United States here, primarily first and foremost. And that's the focus of the executive order. So as I said, we're allowed we have an opportunity to learn from these attacks. And over, you know, decade or so now of ransomware, it's allowed the district to take a look at what has happened to other entities and other peer utilities, which has either allowed us to innovate or it validates network defense approaches that we were already taking. And in this case, we do have strong segmentation between our IT and our OT environments. So segmentation, meaning that the interconnections between IT and OT are narrow and they're specific. They're governed with strong access controls, firewalls, rule sets, other hardware, software, and cryptographic-based defenses to make sure that the limited interconnections that exist between IT and OT exist in a very controlled manner. And that also allows us to be more resilient if we were to face a decision such as Colonial, where we would need to either precautionarily or due to overwhelming evidence that it would be prudent to disconnect SCADA from the IT environment, right? So if we were to disconnect OT from IT, we can operate in an air-gapped OT manner to allow service to continue to be provided in an automated manner. And then further and even beyond that, there are procedures to allow for the operation of SCADA in a manual manner as well. And I am not the expert in this. So if there are questions on this, I would defer to other experts who are on the call. But from a cybersecurity perspective, the interconnection between IT and OT is strong or is limited. And where those connections exist, they're governed by strong controls. And it also allows us to continue on this theme of learning. It's also allowed us to prioritize new or emerging technologies and how we want to implement those into our environment to protect from this type of attack. So we have improved authentication technologies that we're going to be introducing in Q3 and Q4 of this year. So which will change the way we log into our Windows PCs. It'll be user-friendly and relatively transparent to everybody, but it'll provide a lot more protection for authentication and defense against phishing. We also are going to be introducing multi-factor authentication across some Microsoft-based services so that when those services are accessed off of the VPN, those services will be behind multi-factor authentication. And then we're also going to be looking at bringing in some enhanced analytics and human-based threat analytics from some outside sources that specialize in these types of attacks. So we're trying to provide, you know, in that concept of defense in depth or layered defense, we're continuing with our methodology and enhancing that defense in depth methodology by focusing on, you know, how can we secure the human, right? That's the authentication portion. How can we better secure the network? That's your threat analytics. And then also, how are we focusing on just responding to the opportunity or the potential to have to face a decision to precautionarily disconnect OT from IT if we were to be faced with a similar situation. So in terms of mitigating ransomware, I'll run through a real kind of high level and quick assessment of recommended actions versus what we do here at the district. So at the district, we back up our data regularly. We keep software and hardware patched and current updated. We use two-factor authentication to protect our OT environment. And we use strong passwords and other access controls. We do use the latest in AI-based antivirus and threat detection from numerous vendors. So we're not putting all our eggs in one threat detection and vulnerability basket. We actually diversify that to provide increased protection across the enterprise. Strong access control, we talked about that. We regularly scan the network for vulnerabilities. We look for unusual behavior that's automated. We have behavioral analytics that looks for either computers or servers or other electronic devices that may be exhibiting unusual or not before seen behavior. And we have automated alerts for those that will actually trigger or alert someone, you know, in our cybersecurity network infrastructure departments that would then allow us to respond to whatever that anomalous behavior is. And we're tracking known vulnerabilities in software. So as we see vulnerabilities released from vendors and manufacturers saying, hey, we know where there's an issue with this piece of software or hardware, we're aware of that. We track that. We patch that as soon as the patch becomes available. And we have had to do that numerous times in the last couple months in response to some high profile attacks that you've seen in the media, such as Pulse Secure, such as Exchange, SolarWinds. Those types of attacks are really a testament to our ability to respond very quickly to patch and secure vulnerabilities in those pieces of widely used technology. And then, of course, we do have logs for all activity across our IT and OT network. If something were to occur, we do feel confident that we could provide a forensic reconstruction and then actually rebuild and restore the network from backups if we were forced into a situation similar to Colonial, as Colonial had to do anyway, where they ended up restoring their network from backups. So cyber response in general. I probably won't go into too much detail here just to respect this forum, but the district has a multi-layered incident response plan, focusing and prioritizing maintaining availability and reliability of service to our customers. For electrical distribution and generation operations, that is covered by NERC-SIP standards. So NERC-SIP standards do require certain actions and elements of a response for incidents that were to occur in those protected environments. But after those initial actions, then we would transition from the NERC-SIP-based response plan into our district-wide incident response plan, which is based on internationally recognized best practices. And we would respond to any incident, and this could be a cyber incident, this could be a natural disaster, it could be civil unrest. You know, a cyber incident is not, or an incident affecting the IT or OT networks does not necessarily imply that it has to be from a malicious hacker. It can be something that just generally disrupts the operation of the IT or OT network. So we would then respond to that in accordance with those plans. Those plans are specific in terms of governing actions from either specific roles or specific individuals. They're cross-functional and they're multidisciplinary, involving IT, distribution and engineering, legal, CorpCom to promote public awareness, CEO, commissioners, and, you know, among others. And each incident is going to be slightly different from the next. And so while the plan is specific in terms of who is involved, it is, the plans are also written in a manner that allows for deviation to account for specific specifics of a given attack or response effort. So, you know, we believe that they're well thought out. We test them regularly and share lessons learned both internally and externally if we have something to report to the federal government in terms of NERPSIP. So I believe our response plans are healthy, and I believe that they're well thought out. But there's always an opportunity to learn. So we have instituted in response to the colonial attack a cross-functional kind of impact planning group. And that is to take a look at what we do have on the shelf in terms of, you know, what does NERPSIP require? What do our internal plans processes already govern? Where are the gaps? Where are the overlaps? And how can we better plan for either a ransomware or other type of disruptive cyber event that could necessitate us making the type of precautionary decision to take OT or SCADA offline, meaning to just disconnect it from the internet, and it could still function in an air-gapped manner. So that's one option. Or what are the decision-making factors and critical elements that could necessitate a decision to go all the way to manual operation in an unforced or precautionary manner. So we've got experts coming together from IT, from D&E, and generation to discuss those types of events, the thought processes that might go into that, and then eventually to train and exercise those types of plans so that we can potentially be more prepared than Colonial was if this were to occur. I think the bottom line is we feel comfortable at this point that we could operate SCADA manually or electrical distribution manually if the OT infrastructure were somehow compromised. So from a catastrophic response scenario, we feel confident that we have manual procedures in place to provide a baseline of available and reliable service while we identify, assess, respond, mitigate, and otherwise rebuild a network in the event of a cyber attack. So I know I just said a lot of words, and I'm happy to take questions. So thank you very much.
Questions, Commissioner?
I would like to ask, by the way, that was a very comprehensive and very well delivered explanation. Thank you. Thank you very much, Kevin. So about water, when we treat water, is that done by computer when we add chemicals to water? Or if we, you know, if in our water delivery system, is that done by computer?
So this is Brent Wood, AGM of the Water Utility. So we do have PLCs at all of our sites that do control the flow of chemicals at our treatment plants. One of the things that we do when we engineer a treatment plant is we engineer in some, you know, the sizing of the tanks, the day tanks, so that there is no ability to even the sizing of the chemical feed pumps themselves to over ramp to such an extent that it would cause serious damage. I mean, we try to control it that way too, but the SCADA system, the on-site PLC does control the feed of the chemicals at the treatment plants. It does look at the feedback from the analyzers. But in this case, that can be done specifically at the site. So even if our OT side went down, that PLC itself would have to be compromised. And it's separate from the operational side of the system or the network side of the system. No connection to internet, those sort of things. So I think we're fairly secure. We built in kind of those engineering, I guess, limitations as far as in the design of the treatment plants, so that size of the chemical tanks, the day tanks, as well as the chemical feed pumps, are limited. They're not, we don't put a really large tank directly connected to the system. We have to actually go in and for a day tank, the maximum is 3 days worth of capacity in that day tank. So we don't have like 2,000 gallons of chemical feeding that could feed potentially right into the system. So we try to limit that way too, but
Okay.
Did that answer your question, Commissioner Wolf?
Yeah, did you read about the hacker that tried to poison the water at a water utility in Florida?
Yes, I did. And
it was just by chance that the operator for the utility noticed some strange things happening on his computer screen, and he shut it down, and they dealt with it. And also another vulnerability, I read this morning, they did catch the guy who got into our employment system here in the state and stole a lot of data. So, I mean, there are other vulnerabilities other than, you know, just shutdowns. But anyway, it sounds like we've got all the bases covered. Thank you very much, Brant. And I have another question for Kevin. So other vulnerabilities, how does our vulnerability now compare with what, how is it going to be different, if it is, when we go to AMI?
I think the proper response to that is that the attack surface, right, the surface of what a potential attacker could access, by definition, when we expand the size of the network, expands as well, right? So there is just kind of a more is more, right? If we put more endpoints and more technology on the network, what we call the attack surface is going to expand. That's just kind of factual. However, I think that it's equally, if not more important, to say and emphasize that the defenses around the AMI network, I think, are going to be exceptional, and I think are stellar. And I know that we're being progressive relative to many of our peer utilities. When I interact with the vendors associated with this, we're proposing architectures that the vendors, that we're leading them. We're pushing the vendors to be more secure than they are today, mm-hmm. in order to enhance our AMI network security in the future. I'm kind of responding to this in a two-part, because I think that both of them are important. From a fundamental underpinning, if you increase the size of the network, you do increase the size of the attack surface. That's just kind of a fact of growing a network. However, we can also, and we have, use that as an opportunity to leverage our own improvement in cybersecurity internally, but also to push our vendors to come along on that journey with us. And I think that's really the important part that I want to talk about with AMI. And I think the outcome of that is going to be that we have a very secure metering network. We have a very secure distribution automation control network. And we also have an equally secure data network that protects both, the systems involved with control of the network, but also the systems involved with protection and transferring of personal or other sensitive data. So I see a very positive outcome here for us in the future.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
Any more questions for Kevin? Commissioner? Kevin, I've got one quick question. I read an article that said that companies that have cyber insurance are being picked as victims. Of course, we have cyber insurance for more than just this kind of attack. Do you have any thoughts about that? And is there something we should change? Is it helpful, for instance, if a board passes a resolution saying they will never pay a ransom?
I think there's a lot in that question. I'll start with the victim portion, right? You know, is there anything that we can do to decrease the likelihood of becoming a victim? My answer to that is, unfortunately, probably not, right? Any organization or person that has money as a target. And you're right that that certain organizations, like in this case, DarkSide, are saying, hey, you know, we don't do government, you know, we don't attack governments, we don't attack hospitals, we, you know, we don't want to cause social harm or social unrest. Whether that's true or not is a different discussion. But you also have criminal operations who don't care at all about those types of concerns, and they'll go after anybody with an exposed, you know, internet-facing, you know, infrastructure or anybody that they can fish or otherwise socially engineer. And that's not to say that we shouldn't be careful and measured and thoughtful about our cyber insurance response, right? I would say that, you know, obviously these are all matters of public record. I saw Jim, you know, kind of pop on there. So if Jim wants to add anything as I talk along here, Jim and I speak regularly about this. And we have had a lot of conversations recently about the changing market dynamics in the cybersecurity insurance market and how that is starting to influence both public and private entities writ large. And a lot of it is, from my perspective, as a cybersecurity professional, I think it's professional, or it's a positive. It is a good service. Obviously, it's a self-serving service on behalf of the insurance industry, but it is a good service that they provide to force organizations who want to carry cyber insurance to enhance their cybersecurity posture and position. That is a good benefit for society and national infrastructure, right? So, but I to your third question regarding whether or not it is beneficial to have a public statement or pass a resolution, I would want to come back and address that. I think that that's multi-layered, and I would also want to involve, corporate communications and Kim and her government relations teams, because I think that there are some potentially unintended consequences with that. But it's something that we could consider. Just want to make sure that we're being very measured about that.
Kevin, is it even known if Colonial was specifically targeted, or was it just an employee opened up an email attachment?
So I believe it is probably both, right? I believe that they were probably, this is me. In my professional opinion, they were targeted and it was social engineering, right? So they were targeted by a phishing campaign, which is overwhelmingly the most common attack vector these days, right? That's what most organizations can and shouldn't expect. And that's where we are and should be prioritizing our protection and defense efforts, right?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else, commissioners?
All right, great job, Kevin. Really appreciate the overview. Next up is Bill Quinlan to talk about our sustainable field maintenance process. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Click on here. All right. Can you see me and hear me?
Can see your screen.
Okay, terrific.
Oh, wait, let's see.
See here. All right. I want to take a few minutes to talk about our sustainable field maintenance that facilities is involved with out in the field. I guess first off, we'll talk about the sustainable field maintenance values, sort of the who, what, where, when, and why, and how we do what we do, emerging issues and changing times, response to those issues, program updates, property restoration, the improvements we're continuing with, and then time for questions.
Hey, Bill, this is John. Can you, I don't think your camera is on. We can see your screen and we can hear you very well, but I don't think your camera is on.
Okay. The camera is from my phone and it says start video. And then I'm reading, you cannot start your video because the host has disabled it. No worries. Yeah, I'm not sure how to deal with that, but okay, looks like it might be working now.
There you go.
There you go. Okay, terrific.
Yeah, good.
Okay. All right, can you see the full screen?
Yep, everything's great.
Okay, so our sustainable field maintenance values, sustainable maintenance practices, customer service, environmental stewardship, and safety. So everything we do should reflect that. Now I'm not, okay, here we go. Okay, emerging issues. So just a few years ago, how we maintain and take care of our properties has had some challenges. The picture on the far left there, surface water erosion. So, you know, 30 years ago, housing developments were put in and culverts were installed and they drained across our properties. In the meantime, a lot of development has happened. So the flow of water has greatly increased. So we're finding erosion issues at multiple properties, which cause a problem in many ways. The top center picture, developments along our distribution lines in urban areas. We had neighbors adjacent to our properties and they're taking liberties to, for example, here, create a parking lot, spread gravel, utility trailers, that kind of thing. Unauthorized use, basically. The bottom picture there, climate change, increased temperatures. We're finding ornamental landscapes that we had not typically irrigated with supplemental watering where plantings were dying off. So climate change. And then of course on the far right was encampment activity, which our undeveloped properties were ideal for, you know, throughout our urban areas. So in response to those issues, Ann Spangler initiated a property management group, different disciplines and expertise across the district to talk about, you know, how we address these situations, identify them and address them. And as a result, of that group, we sort of came up with the question, what do we need to do to reduce the frequency of those issues and what changes do we need to make? So we took on taking a look at that and field maintenance changes. First things we needed to do was put our program, reassess it and update it. Our policies and commitments, protocols, property information. We coordinated that and documented it and got it in place so we're all on the same page. An example of that would be our field issue response. So typically, we'd have information coming up from many sources and landing at the district in many places. So we developed this response protocol where the incoming information would be disseminated to appropriate groups, which group is responsible for maintenance at that site, which group has expertise related to the situation. And as a result of that, we were able to respond promptly and most appropriately to situations as they came by involving, you know, the appropriate work groups. An example of that would be a picture on the left. Along the interurban trail, we had a large erosion washout, and that situation could have doubled or tripled quickly. So we got real estate involved to contact the local jurisdiction, got facilities involved with the civil engineering, assessed the situation. Then we got Major Yard in there and their equipment mobilized, and we were able to respond and mitigate the situation promptly, effectively, eliminate the potential for it getting worse, and created a safe situation again for that public access area. As far as coordinating information, interurban trail mapping. So we have 16 miles between Everett and Edmonds. Many parcels along the way, different jurisdictions involved. We mapped the sites so that we could identify vehicle access so that if we had emergency or just even regular maintenance, we would be able to know where to access this trail with vehicles. Also notes related to the individual parcels and different situations, environmental, that kind of thing. And also just as a tool to be able to maintain as we're dealing with in-house crews and contractors along the way, just information about that long stretch of trail. So And then we went, so with the information updated, now property restorations. We went out and identified 122 undermaintained parcels. So at one time, the maintenance was adequate, but with the changing times, the different elements that were going on, we had to reassess and reconsider how we were taking care of those properties. So assessed the properties, restored them back to in a way that was consistent with our values, and then assigned those properties for regular inspection and maintenance to the appropriate work group in the district according to their expertise and what their specialty is. I just wanted to go through some examples of the restorations and what we're finding out there. Now the picture on the left was a homeless encampment. You see the little bonfire pit there and the pallets piled up on top of the natural gas pipeline infrastructure there. So that was what I noticed. Then the next time I went back, I noticed that the bonfire had jumped, gone across the grass and onto district property. Fortunately, it didn't get farther, but that's the kind of thing we're finding with encampments is there's always a fire potential because typically they do have a bonfire and really serious situations. So what we've been able to do is get regular inspection to these sites with our security work group, and that has always enabled early identification and then a prompt response so that these situations don't get worse as time goes on. Unauthorized use, another picture of the interurban trail on the left there. The customer had done private plantings, parked their motorhome, their vehicles, and that was really an unsafe situation in a public access area. Picture in the middle, if you look into those bushes, you'll see an encampment going on in there, which was very unsafe for our customers to be using that trail with situation activity like that. We communicated with the customer. Picture on the right, cleared out the brush, had them, move their vehicles, and then we posted the area so that it would, it was clear what was appropriate use. Unauthorized use. These distribution areas were, typically 6 to 12 feet of vegetation, blackberry brush, and customers were taking the liberty to extend their backyards with fencing, which actually, limited access to our infrastructure. Also, limited access for our maintenance activity. For example, the picture in the middle, someone dumped their concrete and metal pipes, which destroyed the, mowing machines that we sent out there. And then on the far right, Jason customer created a motocross track, which of course last time I checked, our service vehicles, our line trucks can't do, moguls. So those are the kind of situations that were going on. Vegetation management. So visual access is really important. In the old days, we would hide our sites to be a good neighbor. But what we're realizing is out of sight means unauthorized illegal activity going on. So we've opened up our areas, still attractive, respectful of the neighborhood, but visual access that enables our security and regular maintenance crews to see across the sites and early identification of any problems. Also, areas out in the open, the frequency of these activities has gone way down because these activities don't like to be out in the open. So that's our approach now. Vegetation management, once again, the picture on the far left was the interurban trail grown up to the edges, very unsafe. Our customers were not using the trail. Read the newspapers, a lot of unfortunate situations going on. Picture in the middle is after we've adopted the policy to clear fence to fence. We leave the nice native vegetation, the trees, but we're clearing the brush and limbing up trees, cutting down brush so that people have a visual sight line. And once again, unauthorized activity just isn't happening because it doesn't like to happen out in the open. And then on the far right, hazard trees we're able to identify much more easily when we've cleared away the brush and we can are enabled to inspect our sites quickly and efficiently. Signposting, fair enough. We had a lot of properties that really didn't communicate what the restrictions were to our properties and what was okay. So our properties sort of looked lonely and not cared about. So we've gone to quite a bit of effort and identified property lines, which is a picture on the far left. We've posted signage letting people know what's okay and not okay on our properties. Picture second from the right there is just posting basically, this is when you're, where your backyard stops and PUD property starts. That way we're eliminating storage sheds, dumping, playground sets, all kind of stuff on district property that leads to us not being able to maintain our property. And the picture on the far right is posting signs that we're unable to enforce parking situations. The picture on the far right is they're blocking access to one of our substations by parking there on a regular basis. So we restricted access to our properties as well. The picture on the far right, that's along Highway 99 in Linwood, and certain people were heading off the highway, walking down the sides of our substations, then heading out back and out of sight areas, and all kinds of not okay stuff was going on. So we've fenced between the substation fence and our property line fence. That's greatly reduced any kind of activity like that going on. Picture second from the right, that's just a typical distribution line through an urban area, uncared about, and all kinds of stuff going on, dumping, structures, encroachments. So the picture on the far right is we fenced it off with a gate that gives our line trucks and vehicles access for maintenance, but also eliminates motor vehicles from the public that are not authorized to be there. And we post our, you know, the signage of what's appropriate, what's not. Access to infrastructure. So once again, supporting our line crews to do service on our lines. The picture on the far left is what we started with, a gate that wouldn't open all the way because the neighborhood was dumping their organic debris behind the fence. Also, the slope was so steep that the trucks couldn't get up that slippery slope. So bottom right, we cleared out the debris, posted signs of what's appropriate and what's not, redid the driveway so the line trucks can get up and do their work. But you'll also notice it's not a solid fence where the neighbors can't walk their dogs, throw a frisbee, that kind of thing. We just don't want, you know, dumping, encroachment, motor vehicles, that kind of thing. So we want to be a good neighbor as well. And then top pictures, we had a schedule of once every 3 years clearing these distribution lines. But we found out once again, out of sight areas encourage all those unauthorized uses. So now we're doing it once a year, and we've identified a lot of unauthorized use, as well as it's not happening now because it's out in the open. We identify it early, or people just aren't tending to do it. Limited use permits. For a long time, there was a limited use permit protocol where the customers would call and we'd give them a permit to use our property. Well, what we were finding is they gained, you know, a field ownership of that property and inevitably led to fencing off the properties. So the picture on the left there, they had a wire fence. They also had an electric fence. So, and as you'll see, we cannot access our power lines. So to be fair, another concern of the customer was four-wheel drive enthusiasts were coming off the road and driving the power lines. There's a real nuisance to the neighbors, beer cans on the ground, that kind of thing. And we do, one of our values is customer service. So we had them remove the fences, but we did create a barrier at the end of the roads that our maintenance crews could access the site, but also met the customer needs to not have that kind of nuisance unauthorized use going on. Surface water management. So we weren't really aware well enough of the culverts on our properties. We started having washouts and erosion, that kind of thing. So we needed to identify those culverts and do a regular inspection and maintenance. First step, of course, as we've been talking about, is do vegetation management, clearing out the areas, and then doing a regular clean out of the culverts and inspecting them and keeping them available and documenting their locations. Environmental stewardship. The way we do maintenance. Picture on the left is if a tree dies, in the past we would cut it down. Now we're leaving a stump for cavity dwelling habitat. And the picture on the left is just 3 years later, you know, a lot of bird activity in that stump, getting benefit for that. The picture in the middle is 75th Street Business Center with those three deer. Wildlife all over the place. Just the other day, I was in our irrigation boxes. I saw frogs, salamanders, all kinds of stuff. So we want to encourage that. In the picture on the far right, you and our ornamental plantings, one of the requirements for our plantings is that they provide wildlife habitat and food. So easy enough. In this area of the world, we have a great selection of plant material to choose from. So our plant selections are drought tolerant, disease resistant, wildlife friendly, that kind of thing. Also, environmental stewardship as far as supporting habitat. The picture on the left is we're eliminating and managing invasive vegetation such as blackberries and scotch broom so that the native plants can thrive. Also, you'll see the marker on the left. That's communication to our maintenance people. Don't go beyond this because there's a regulated waterway 100 feet downstream of that marker. So we make sure that we don't violate local codes as far as how we maintain our sites. And the picture in the middle is once again, one of those culverts installed 30 years ago during rain events, big flush of water creating erosion. So we restored that type of site. The picture on the right, we've signed those areas, marked boundaries that are appropriate and replanted with native vegetation appropriate for critical area water situations. Climate change. So fire control is a serious consideration of ours. A picture on the top left is basically we want to eliminate fuel to help that would help the fires take off. So picture on the top left, typical wood debris, limbs that built up over time. Now we're going in, we're mulching those with our vegetation mulching machines, leaving just the mulch on the ground. It's good for the soil and also eliminates that fuel to support any fire incident. Bottom left is our open fields. We mow once a year, and our goal and what we do is before July 4th, they're all mowed to the ground. Picture on the left is a fire that happened over the 4th of July weekend. Fortunately, we had mowed that the week before, so the grass was real short and the fire spread in a minimal way. And also by the time the fire department got there, it had not spread in a way that got out of control. Mm-hmm. That would have been our, you know, older approach of 2 feet of, you know, dry grass, probably could have been a worse situation. The bottom center is we're also revegetating with a drought tolerant, low growing clover mix that stays green through the summer so that it's not fuel for the fire, and also wildlife friendly with the clover involved. And then on the far right, we're eliminating formal turf at our different situation, different sites that needs, you know, servicing every 2 weeks, fertilizer, supplemental irrigation. And we're going to drought-tolerant plantings that are perfectly appropriate and extremely largely less maintenance requirements. And of course, we're continuing our improvements on all the subjects we've talked about. We're continuing to look at those and continually make improvements. And if this any questions out there, I just wanted to say that I think as our new approach, we've greatly reduced the frequency of undesirable situations out there, and we're much more in line with our field maintenance values as far as how our sites reflect, you know, what they look like. So
questions, commissioners?
I just have a comment. I find this presentation to be extremely valuable. I had no idea of the extent of the work that you do, and it's enormous, and I really, really appreciate it. I did have just one probably really easy question, and if you can go back to slide number 7, where you have that chart, where would you put, well, first, the interurban trail. We have easements. But who actually owns the lands? I know that it crosses a lot of different distinctions, you know, in the land.
But, sure. So on the interurban trail, we have lease agreements with the different jurisdictions, whether it be Snohomish County, Everett, Linwood, Edmonds, Valley Terrace. Okay. And they're responsible for the hard surface and some feet outside of the trail. And the district is responsible for the rest. And PUD owns all the properties.
Oh, we own all the properties?
along the interurban trail. Now, there are some gaps where the trail stops, there's some sidewalk, that kind of thing, and starts up again. That was why it was so important to map the interurban trail. Mm-hmm. Also down at Edmonds, I believe the city of Edmonds owns a few parcels along the trail, but vast majority are owned by the district. And they're public access areas, and we have lease agreements with the different jurisdictions, the different cities and county, as far as our management of those sites.
Okay, so under which column would you put maintenance of, like, people drop doggy poop bags and they drop their cans and lots of litter? Because somebody in my district contacted me and said that, she said, can you tell the people at the PUD we need more disposal, you know, places
sure. to
put things, because she, this woman and her friend walk their dogs there and they take an extra bag and they do some voluntary pickup. But she said it just, she was asking me who does that, and I said, "Well, I'll have to ask."
Sure, I have seen the doggy.
I'm sorry, I was just going to add. Sure. I said, "Why don't you send me photos, and I'll pass them on to the right person."
Sure, and what city she lives in? I've noticed that those dog stations are on along the trail in along some jurisdictions. Uh-huh. So the jurisdictions maintain the trail, I believe, like 5 feet either side of the trail. And they have park signs and that kind of thing, because they are the city, they're city parks, public access city parks. So I would think perhaps the local jurisdiction that has a lease agreement to maintain that section would be one to contact.
Okay, I'll tell
you. And they also have park rangers that get out there and patrol the trails as well.
And is that a voluntary group? A volunteer group, the park rangers?
Commissioner Wolf, if this is Spender, if I could add a couple of comments.
Sure.
Since we're not typically, you know, as the PUD, we're sort of in the electric business, not the public recreation business.
Right.
That's why we have the lease agreements with the jurisdictions, so that they can maintain the trails.
Okay.
Otherwise, you know, we're not responsible for maintaining the trail itself. We have a cooperative relationship where they take care of the trail itself, and as Bill's been describing, 5 feet on either side.
Okay.
And so that's why we try to direct those kinds of questions to the local jurisdiction. And I think some of them do better than others in terms of how well they maintain their sections of the trail.
Okay.
Does that help?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, thank you. A lot of people walk their dogs, they use the doggy bag, but then they leave, they leave it on the side. They don't put it in the container, you know, the garbage cans or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. So the cities would need to increase the litter disposal equipment if they were going to improve that. It would be
the that's the model that we have.
Okay. So it would kind of go under, well, it's not our responsibility. So, I mean, I was trying to put it into one of these columns, that situation with people leaving litter. And I thought, environmental? I don't think so. Well, not really.
I think that's a good question about communication with the local jurisdiction. And so that can be either through real estate, who maintains the lease agreements, uh-huh. or through facilities, just to make sure that the information is getting from the PUD to the local jurisdiction. That's Bill, great. If you have anything to add.
Yeah, I think that's a great, great thought, is to communicate with the local jurisdictions. It is their parks, and they do care about, you know, those public access areas, and they do those pet stations at their parks. Mm-hmm. I think probably we could use more of those for sure.
Yeah, and then all the plastic bottles and things. You said they're, what did you call them, park rangers?
Yeah, the cities have, you know, the interurban trail is a park site for the different cities, and they send their park rangers out to patrol the trails and monitor them, that kind of thing. So they're involved for sure.
So are they city employees or volunteers?
Yes, they are. They're city employees. Okay, or county employee, sure.
Very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
And this is Commissioner Olson. I've got one question and then an observation. My question is around the LUPs. Mm-hmm. And are we no longer issuing them? And B, what does it mean cancel when possible?
I'm not an expert on those, but we have been not renewing them. Because in reality, they limit our access to those sites and cause, and they're not managed according to our values because they're under the control of the permit holder. So we are moving towards not renewing them.
Okay.
And as far as when possible, that's where I'm not sure of all the dynamics involved. Real estate oversees those permits, but we are looking at, and real estate's looking at reassessing how we issue those permits or not. And we're tending to not continue those.
Thank you. And my second is an observation. And I commend staff for establishing this centralized protocol. It's been needed for years. Mm-hmm. And to bring together from throughout the district the multi-disciplines to handle a centralized IDing the issues, responding to the issues, keeping a centralized database, and job well done. I really am very pleased with this. Thank you.
Thank you. I do believe we're fortunate to have a lot of expertise and work groups with a lot of ability. It's really nice to be able to resource that at a moment's notice, and we get our best result because of that. Thank you.
Well done.
Yeah, I'll just add on to that. Thank you, Bill. Great presentation. It's impressive to see what we're doing on behalf of our customers to be good stewards of these lands. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
This is Jason.
Sorry.
I just wanted to recognize Bill. He's done an outstanding job leading this program. And in my time here at the district, I've seen the maintenance of our facilities really improve. Seen that in substation and he just does a great job of coordinating across the company, and it provides great access for our workers to be able to get in and maintain our facilities, mm-hmm. respond to emergencies, and do their work. So really appreciate Bill and everything he does.
Thanks, Jason.
I already said I'm just really impressed with the scope of your work, and I also appreciate the dedication. And I did want to go back to a picture about a beaver dam. So are you capturing and putting them in other places, or what are you doing if they're causing a problem?
That's our environmental group is in charge of that. So I would have to ask them how they approach that. I know that's one of their specialties, to be sure. Christoph would be the one who knows about that. So
I know some people call them nature's engineers, but a lot of people in developed areas don't like those engineers.
Yeah, I went to a seminar last year in City of Seattle, King County. They're embracing the beavers more and more because of their way they control surface mm-hmm. water runoff. I spoke mm-hmm. about how we're getting these greater flows across our properties. The right. beaver can be worked with as part of that.
And in some places, they're really valuable in restoring watersheds, but usually at the higher elevations and the undeveloped areas. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's pretty exciting work that you folks are doing. So I'm very grateful to you.
All right. Thank you, Bill. Great job.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. Fantastic presentation and a huge kudos to spearheading this effort. I've seen just tremendous improvements in our processes over the past year or so, and you've been a big part of that. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Next up is Ian Hunter, who's going to talk about our renewal of our third party operating reserves contract. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning, John. Good morning, commissioners. We'll do a quick sound check, make sure everything's going right on the tech side.
Sound good. I'm sorry you have to follow cute beavers and deer.
I know, not quite as exciting and visually stimulating, but This is everyone's favorite biannual, you know, reminder slash refresher on operating reserves. So I have faith that we can plug through it. A little bit of a review about what we are going to be talking about today. We're going to talk about what operating reserves are. And one last thing for the record, Ian Hunter, power analyst in the power supply department. What we're going to do today, we're going to talk a little bit about what operating reserves are. We're going to talk about what they've cost in the past and what they cost now, do some history about how we've managed our operating reserves contracts and our operating reserve obligation. We'll talk about what our existing agreement looks like with our current provider, and then we'll give you a staff recommendation about how we see this kind of moving forward in the future. And if there's any questions along the way, if, you know, I think I got all the acronyms defined first, but if there's any you're unsure about, please feel free to just jump right in. So what are operating reserves? So operating reserves serve a purpose for grid reliability. Every balancing authority or BA has to set aside some generating capacity that you can basically have available in case there's some kind of forced outage or other reliability problem that occurs on the system. That reserve capacity is called operating reserves, and it really has two elements. The first is what you call spinning reserve, which is basically capacity that's just online and can come on at the drop of a hat. It's already spinning, ready to go. The other is called supplemental reserves, and these are reserves that are ready within, you know, roughly 10 to 15 minutes. So things that can ramp up really quickly to cover a need, but aren't that instantly, you know, ready to go type of capacity. We exist within Bonneville's balancing authority. So Bonneville has the overall kind of reliability obligation for the BA, but we have to contribute our share of those operating reserves to Bonneville in order to make sure that we're, you know, covering our reliability obligations. One thing that Bonneville does allow for in their operating reserve business practices, we can either contract with Bonneville, where Bonneville provides the operating reserves and we pay them just to kind of do it on our behalf, or we can contract with a third party to provide operating reserves on our behalf instead of Bonneville. How much operating reserves are we actually talking about? How much generation is actually being held on to the system out there? The Western Electricity Coordinating Council, or WECC, is kind of the entity that's responsible for coordinating and making sure that the bulk electric system is reliable in the Western Interconnection. Their standards say that we have to set aside sufficient capacity to cover 3% of our load and 3% of generation. So whatever our load is in a particular hour, we have to have 3% generation set aside for that. And whatever our generation is, we have to have 3% set aside for that amount. So roughly comes out to 3% on each side.
Ian, is that our own generation, like Jackson, or is that?
Yep, that's our own generation. Okay. Generation that we are kind of responsible for. Our maximum operating reserve requirement last year was about 74 megawatts in December of 2020. So, you know, those cold winter peak periods where our load is really high, we have a lot of generation that we're trying to serve that load with. That kind of is where we peaked out at that 74 megawatts, just to give you kind of a sense of scale of what these requirements are in kind of the worst case, quote unquote, scenario. And I will point out that this is capacity that we're talking about. So this is capacity that has to be available. So even though we had an operating reserve requirement of 74 megawatts, that doesn't mean that we actually deployed that energy. That energy is just kind of set aside in case there's a reliability problem on the system. So how much do they cost? You know, we've kind of talked a little bit about the quantity, but the cost is, of course, another important aspect. The rate is, of course, determined by every provider. You know, different providers will have different costs for what capacity costs them, and then how much it costs to provide to others. Bonneville's BP20 rate was about $9.53 for spinning reserves and $8.32 for supplemental reserves, and that's per megawatt hour. You can see that the spinning reserve is, of course, more expensive than the supplemental service because you have to have that generator online ready to go at a moment's notice. So there's just kind of some increased costs associated with that. And that's pretty typical. Seattle City Light, who is our current provider of third-party operating reserves, have typically offered their product at a discount to the full BPA tariff rate. So whatever BPA's rate is, Seattle's just kind of said, we'll give you a flat discount on what Bonneville establishes. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. In terms of what it means for our budget, our annual cost for operating reserves is about $4.5 million.
Excuse me for interrupting, Ian. How is it that Seattle City Light has so much operating reserve to sell? Is it because of their Skagit system or what?
Yeah, so that's exactly right. Seattle has a number of generating facilities that they are able to leverage, and they have that surplus capacity available that if they weren't selling it to someone else, may potentially go unused. So they're really looking to kind of extract that value out of having that capacity available for others to offer this product.
Thank you.
Yeah. A little bit of history, you know, what have we done in the past? You know, looking back, it does always help inform future decisions. We self-provided our operating reserves by setting aside some capacity from our slice product during kind of what we call the subscription contract era. 2001 to 2011, our Bonneville contract allowed us to set aside a portion of our slice to provide these reserves. Once we moved into the regional dialogue contract starting in 2012, that self-supply provision was eliminated from the slice product. So couldn't do that anymore, kind of put us into a position where we're either buying it from Bonneville or we're getting it from a third-party provider. Since that time, we've contracted with either Seattle City Light or BPA Transmission for this service. We are currently in a 2-year operating reserve agreement with Seattle that expires September 30th, 2021. So coming up in September on the end of that. And I'll also point out that the third-party operating reserve agreements usually line up evenly with Bonneville's rate periods. So they're 2-year agreements, starting when the Bonneville rate period starts, ending when the Bonneville rate period ends. So what does our current contract with Seattle look like? What are kind of the terms, the conditions? Seattle provides 100% of our operating reserve obligation. So whatever our needs might be, they could provide them in any given hour. In the event that Bonneville calls upon Snohomish's reserves, Seattle would be the one who actually deploys those reserves on our behalf. The agreement caps out the amount of discounted hourly operating reserves to 98 megawatts. So, you know, if you recall, our highest obligation was 74 megawatts last year. So we have quite a bit of room in that cap to cover that that amount. If we were to need more than 98 megawatts of operating reserve capacity, there would be a $20 per megawatt surcharge that would be assigned to that. And that's just to protect Seattle in the event that, you know, we need more capacity than we expected. But in historical periods, we have not come close to exceeding that that capacity cap. And as I mentioned before, Seattle's rate is pretty much just a flat discount on what the established Bonneville rate is, and they come in at a 54-cent discount, and that's to both the spinning rate and the supplemental rate. So you take Bonneville's rate, you knock 54 cents off of it in both cases, and that's what Seattle is proposing to charge us. Or I guess I should say that's what they are charging us now. But that moves us forward to what we're talking about now, which is what we do for the future. Seattle is proposing to basically extend the agreement, same terms and conditions. The 54 cent discount is the same. It would be based off of what the new rates are in Bonneville's rate schedules starting in 2022, or the fiscal year 2022. Power Scheduling did kind of a survey of other possible providers of third-party operating reserves. We found that Seattle was the lowest rate, partially because Seattle is one of the only other third-party providers of operating reserves that's out there. The other entities that have that capacity don't necessarily offer this product into Bonneville for whatever reason. Again, Seattle's offered identical terms and pricing for that rate period. And so staff is really recommending that we renew the operating reserves agreement. Seattle's been a reliable partner in the past, looking at this. They provide a reliable service, and they provide it at a discount to the rate that Bonneville could provide it. We currently have the agreement in principle, but we're still kind of working on that final contract language. So pending final contract language agreement and legal sign-off, we could bring a contract back to you as in the form of a resolution at a later commission meeting date. So that kind of wraps it up on operating reserves. That was the quick crash course. Any questions about operating reserves, how they're handled, or the proposed contract structure that we're looking at with Seattle?
Questions, Commissioner? Mm-mm. Ian, I just have one. So if a call is made on Seattle and for some reason Seattle has difficulty meeting that call, do they have to essentially rob their own system, their own customers to provide that capacity?
So the way the system works, if Seattle is unable to provide the operating reserves, then they are part of a reserve sharing group that the entire region participates in. So those operating reserves would come from somewhere. I'm not sure necessarily that Seattle would, you know, kind of impact their own system in order to provide them. But Seattle would be potentially subject to penalties if they were unable to meet their obligations under the operating reserve agreements. So there's penalties involved, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the lights wouldn't come on for Seattle customers.
Got it, thank you.
So aren't we considering joining the EIM, Energy Imbalance Market? Is that am I confusing things when I ask that?
So they're related concepts, but not necessarily the same. So the energy imbalance market is really looking at more of imbalance, not necessarily on a reliability scale, but more kind of on a market scale. So you're looking at, you know, 5 or 15 minute increments for market transactions versus operating reserves, which are really looking more at the reliability of the system, you know, kind of keeping the lights on. So they're related concepts, but they're not necessarily talking about the same type of operations.
Yeah, I hope, excuse me, I was just going to say I need to get a better grasp of that. So, but anyway, go ahead.
I was just going to add that you would have operating reserves regardless of whether or not, you know, you're in the EIM or out of the EIM. Mm-hmm. They're just a standard kind of practice mm-hmm. in the industry for maintaining reliability of the system.
Okay.
Yep. Thanks. Great point, Jason. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you, commissioners.
John, do you want to take, you're muted. Do you want to take a short break?
Sure. Let's take a short break.
Okay, so let's take about an 8 minute break and let's come back at 10:30. All right, 10:30 and we are back.
Okay, next up is our public electric vehicle fast chargers that we have at the PUD headquarters and the rates from Brian Booth. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, everyone. And good morning, commissioners. I'm Brian Booth, Senior Manager of Rates, Economics, and Energy Risk Management at the PUD. Joining me today, I have Susie Oversby and David Popage, who will be chiming in at the appropriate times. So let's go ahead and jump right into it. We're going to be talking about the proposed rates for the retail DC fast chargers that we're looking to locate at the electric building in downtown Everett. So we'll give you a quick overview of how that project's coming along, and then a look at how those prices have shaken out. So on the overview side, we'll take a quick update of the project and our partner agreements. We have an updated timeline for you. On the rate making, we'll be looking at the goals of the rate making and some of the assumptions that go into that, along with draft rates and how those compare to other retail DC fast chargers. So for the project overview, I'm going to hand it over to Susie Oversby, who's doing a lot of the coordination on this project. Susie?
Sure. Yeah, good morning. Glad to be here to give an update on this project this morning. So as you probably recall, we received a grant award from Washington Department of Ecology just about a year ago to install two DC fast chargers outside of the electric building right there on California. And you'll see that kind of an artist's rendering of what that will look like there on the slide. We had two agreements that needed to be put in place in order to make this happen. And we brought both of those to you via separate resolutions in December. The first was the grant agreement with the Department of Ecology. And then the second was a host operator agreement and limited use license with the City of Everett. And that's because we are installing the chargers on City of Everett right of way. And City of Everett's been a great partner. They supported the grant proposal with a letter from the mayor, and they've been involved in reviewing the designs and helping with signage. And Dave will talk a little bit more about that. We appreciate that you approved the resolutions in December, and we are looking to have these installed this summer. I'm going to pass it over to Dave to kind of dive into the details of the timeline.
Hey everyone, yeah, quick project update here. The PUD line work was scheduled to be done April 24th, but was actually delayed due to what crews thought was asbestos that they found in the existing material. Work was immediately stopped and our crews followed with proper disposing of this material to get it tested. The results came back actually negative, so that's very good for us. But kudos to our crews for putting safety first there. So work has been rescheduled, and this actually does not delay the overall project. We just got our construction drawings completely done, and I've been working on the bid documents this week, hoping to get it done here very soon. We're still looking to have construction done early July, and the units be ready for usage shortly after that. Back to Brian.
On the rates. Okay, so looking at the rate-making goals of this project, we are looking to recover the PUD's costs of installing and maintaining the chargers, including the cost of purchasing, maintaining, and eventual replacement of the charging devices. We also want to cover our costs of construction of electrical and civil infrastructure required to support those chargers, and of course, the cost of electricity, which we've billed to ourselves essentially at Schedule 20, our standard rate for that size of load. We're also looking to pass the benefits of the state grant directly to the customers who use the chargers through discounted charging rates. So we'd be netting off from our gross cost of construction the benefits of that grant. We're also looking to craft rates that are cost competitive and similar in structure to national charging networks. So for customers who pull up to the pump, so to speak, our rates would look very similar to what they'd normally expect to pay at an EV fast charger. So in order to do that, we had to make a number of assumptions. On the cost side, we have fairly firm numbers of $119,000 for the charger cost at its initial purchase, offset by 80% matching grant funds. We've assumed a five-year life on this, which matches the warranty period of the chargers. They could last longer, but we're assuming conservatively here. It is fairly high-tech equipment, so it's not hard to imagine that these would have a fairly short life, at least in the early years of this evolving technology. We're also assuming $143,000 in electrical and civil work to host the chargers, with $21,000 of that being funded by grant funding. And we're expecting a much healthier 35-year life, as is typical of this kind of infrastructure. So to craft rates, it's, of course, we make it a little more complicated than this, but it's really just cost divided by volume to come up with your cost per kilowatt hour. And that volume, we've assumed a 10-year ramp up to a steady 150,000 kilowatt hours in annual sales. This is very similar assumptions to what's used by a neighboring utility. I'm not sure if they'd like me saying their name out loud, but it ends in City Light. And these rates would be updated over time based on actual sales. So we'd be making small incremental improvements over time as the data gets better. So here's our draft retail rates on the left and how they compare with Electrify America on the right, where we have local Electrify America charging stations. So for our charging rate, we're looking at about 35 cents per kilowatt hour. Below that, we do have an overage rate of 39 cents per minute. That's different than the per kilowatt hour charge. This is a per minute idle fee, essentially, for cars that park at these chargers after they're done charging. So we'd offer a 10-minute grace period where they can, you know, finish getting their coffee or using the restroom or whatever they're doing. But then we would expect them to get back in their car and move on so that someone else could use the charger. For comparison, Electrify America on the right comes in a little bit more expensive at 43 cents per kilowatt hour and a 40 cent per minute idle fee with that same 10-minute grace period. So the structure would be basically identical to Electrify America's, but our prices would be somewhat cheaper on the kilowatt hour rate and just a hair cheaper on that idle charge. I'm going to pause here. Are there any questions on the pricing?
Who owns the Electrify America chargers?
Ooh, I bet Susie could chime in on who the actual owner is, but I believe it's a public entity that's funded by the Volkswagen settlement funds.
Oh, okay.
Huh. And you know, I actually am not 100% sure about that. If Shelley is on the phone, she could answer that, but I'm not sure if she's here today. So we can get an answer.
I did jump on, and yes, indeed, they are a subsidiary of the Volkswagen settlement.
Okay. And did they have to negotiate with Everett, the city of Everett, to locate their chargers?
Yeah, actually, Electrify America negotiated with private companies with national accounts. So they're primarily located at Targets, Fred Meyers, Walmarts. So those are individual negotiations with each of those organizations where they're leasing property within their parking lots.
Interesting. Thank you.
Yes.
So next steps, assuming that the commission gives us the smiling nods today, we'd be returning June 1st for consideration of a retail rate schedule. We, of course, have to complete project construction, our setup with ChargePoint, and we're optimistic that customers will be able to plug in and really July 2021. Any further questions?
For the team, commissioners?
Mr. Olson, I have a couple questions. You may have said this and it went right over my head, but at the rates you're proposing, we're recovering our cost of service.
Yes, that's right.
Okay, again, number two. It's
based on the accuracy of those assumptions, but we'll be updating them as time goes on.
Yeah, I get that. And number two, are these dedicated for customer usage only?
I would punt that to Susie.
Sure, they're going to be open to the public, you know, and so yeah, I think there's still policy that probably needs to be developed. But right now, we're anticipating that anyone can plug in, and your employees would just be held to the same standards as the public, and yeah.
That's the nature of my question. Okay.
Any other questions?
So are we going to be on the national map of where, so if people are out traveling, they can look on their Department of Energy provided map and find that we have two chargers so they can just pull off the freeway and charge up? I mean, I would assume we'll be on their map. Is that likely, probable?
Yeah, not only is it on is it going to be on ChargePoint's app or just even searching their sites, it's also going to be advertised on the highway and throughout the city on the way to the headquarters building.
At some point, I heard that the Department of Energy also is going to have a map of along all the different routes, especially the the federal highways, that they will have indicators of where people can pull off and recharge. I don't know.
I've not heard about that, but I would expand on what Dave said, that this would be pulled into the ChargePoint network map, which does roll up into a number of aggregators. So really any of the commonly used charger maps should pick this up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I just have one question. I'm just curious, I don't own an electric vehicle yet, but I was surprised to see the 40 cents a minute. So are vehicle owners pretty savvy about knowing when their charging is complete and can get out there within that 10 minute time frame? Or
it should be fairly straightforward to estimate, yes. And I believe if they're using the ChargePoint app to charge, that it would notify them as soon as they're done charging. Mm-hmm. We didn't want to be too strict about the grace period. 10 minutes seemed reasonable, but I would certainly hope that if I was waiting in line, that the person in front of me would be, you know, respectful and move on once their time is done.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
The other thing, I was just going to add that we have the ability to change and update these rates as time goes on. As we get feedback from customers or get a better idea of what the utilization rates are. Of course, coming back to you, but we can be somewhat flexible and adaptive to our customer needs.
Can you give us an update, probably Susie, I'm not sure who, on how many EV cars are now licensed in Snohomish County? Approximately.
Yeah, I've got that, Commissioner Wolf. It's, if I recall correctly, I want to say it's just over 7,200.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you, team. Great presentation. Excited to see this happen.
Thank you. We're excited to see it go live, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you. An exciting project. Great job, Brian, Susie, David, and Shelley, all of you. I love the team approach on the presentation. So lastly, for this morning's session, we've got Chuck Peterson with a new fiber optics agreement. Good morning, Chuck. Maybe we have Chuck.
Okay, now can you hear me?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, and now I'm trying to reestablish video.
Hey, we see okay. Something.
There you are. There we go. Okay, now it's great to see you all. Morning, John. Good morning, commissioners. Great
morning.
To be here. It's been a while since I've been able to present to you, so it's nice to be here. When I'm emceeing the PUD customer breakfast, I usually like to start off with trivia. So this morning's trivia is that it was 41 years ago today, about 2 hours ago, that Mount St. Helens exploded. Mm-hmm. And as someone who was in Eastern Washington at the time, I received about 6 inches of ash and saw total darkness during the daytime. So it's something that leaves an impression on you. So
I was in Spokane, Chuck, and I was out mowing the lawn in that afternoon. And all of a sudden I thought maybe it was a nuclear holocaust or something. It was it was terrifying. And I had a swimming pool in the backyard and we had to shut everything down. I'll never forget it. Yep.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. You could not stay clean. And, you know, with 6 inches of dust and people's cars weren't operating, and it was phenomenal. Just phenomenal. Anyway, on to our topic this morning, the new fiber optic lease agreement between the PUD and the city of Everett. And that doesn't sound like the most exciting topic, but this is actually part of a bigger story. As with other projects we've had with the city, this is part of an ongoing partnership between the city and the PUD to better serve our common customers. This agreement will enhance the reliability of both the city's and the PUD's water systems benefiting the community. The city actually supplies 80% of the water for the county. And as you know, we're 100% of the electricity supply. So we have a very large common customer base for these two essential services. And so a strong partnership between us is in the best interest of our customers. So the overview for the requested commission action, it would be approval of a resolution allowing the PUD to lease fiber to the city of Everett for its water supply system. And this would replace an existing PUD agreement of leasing old technology, microwave and copper wire with modern fiber technology. And just as fiber is the backbone of our PUD communication system, the leased fiber would be the backbone of the city of Everett's water supply system communications. And just as our own standard is the minimum of two fibers for reliability purposes, the lease would include a primary fiber and a redundant fiber to enhance reliability. And here's a graphic of the proposed fiber lease. It would start up in the mountains at the city of Everett's water filtration plant, as you know, adjacent to our Jackson hydroelectric plant, and then proceed down to the electric building where it'd make the connection to the city of Everett. Now, Commission Resolution 5606, which was passed back in October of 2012, the resolution limits the PUD's ability to provide dark fiber to non-PUD entities. And basically, the crux of that policy was the PUD is not in the fiber business. We build fiber to serve our own system. As I'd mentioned, this would benefit both the PUD and the city systems. And staff has determined that the proposed fiber route has capacity beyond our current and future needs. So we're recommending a one-time exception to Resolution 5606. Now, the mutual benefits that I had mentioned, obviously for the city, this would become the backbone of their communication system for their water supply. And for both their water and sewer supply, this would provide them situational awareness and control for their major facilities. And the fiber is simply faster, has greater bandwidth, and is more reliable than the old technology. Now, the benefits to the PUD, well, our water system, the city is our wholesale supplier. So when we enhance their reliability, it enhances reliability for our own water system. In addition to that, the city supplies water to our major facilities, the electric building, ops, the community offices. And then in our generation side, it not only supplies potable water to the Jackson Project, but also water for cooling of equipment at the Jackson Project. And as I'd mentioned, the ongoing partnership with the city of, or the city of Everett, that critically important. An example of that to start off with the Jackson Project and the water filtration project and the water filtration plant, the cooperation there. Example of that would be the cost sharing agreement that we worked out with them that our folks in generation had worked out with the city a few years ago, and the ongoing cooperation and joint operations. Also, from the water filtration plant down to the population center with the city's distribution for their water and sewer systems, system planning, protection, distribution engineering, substations, key accounts. We have done a number of projects and developed operating agreements with the city to enhance the electrical reliability to their key facilities. And not only does that enhance the reliability of their water supply, but it also reduces the possibility of sewage spills into the Puget Sound and the Snohomish River. And then finally, the city has been a great partner with us for for energy efficiency. An example of that is their wastewater treatment plant was part of our wastewater energy coaching cohort with our energy engineers. And the first year they were part of that cohort, they saved over 20% in energy, 2.7 million kilowatt hours, saved them, avoided cost of approximately $220,000, which is what, about three full-time employees. So we've had a very good partnership with them, and this lease agreement is part of that ongoing relationship. So to sum up, the proposed fiber lease will make the city's water treatment and delivery systems more reliable. It provides reliability benefit to our own operations and water supply, and leasing the fiber is mutually beneficial to both our parties. So the recommendation is commission approval at your next meeting on June 1st of a master license agreement with the primary and redundant fiber included in the lease. And I also want to add that we had an excellent PUD team working on this. We had Nick Johnson, the manager of telecommunications, Brad Spangler, senior manager for generation engineering, Sarah DiVittorio, the assistant general counsel, Brant Wood, the AGM of water, and Mo Matthews, manager of joint use and permits. So we would be happy to take any questions you may have on the proposed lease agreement.
Any questions, commissioners?
Well, I would like to know if Everett, I know that they agreed to, after about 15 years of negotiation, they agreed to the big water agreement with new pipes. And so does Everett supply the water to the Tulalip Reservation?
I think that's out of the scope of this fiber thing.
It has to do with the electricity to support the water that goes, I'm not sure, I'm just asking. I don't think it's...
I defer to Brant on that, but they supply the water to 80% of the county and most of the systems. And The other water would be, as my understanding, is groundwater sources.
Oh.
So I don't know if Brant's still on the line.
Yeah, this is the Brant Wood AGM of the water utility. So yes, their agreement with the tribes, mm-hmm. they are supplying water to that, what they call the big water pipeline. Moving to the reservation and north.
Okay, so our support of this would help provide benefit to the tribes too, right? In a way.
As well as what Chuck was saying, that 80% of the population of Snohomish County is served directly from the city of Everett's water supply. So.
Right, well, I thought it was relevant.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Any other questions, commissioners? You know, this project looks great to me. My questions really are about resolution 5606. So I downloaded it from the state archives, and I'm just sort of surprised. Well, I'm sort of surprised we have a resolution that says we're not going to do something anymore instead of just not doing it. I'm wondering if this resolution is still relevant and if we should still have it. You know, we're cooperating with the broadband access team of the county, and I know we've talked with cities about mapping out our infrastructure to see if there's some places that, you know, we can help each other. So are there any thoughts about whether in this day and age this resolution is relevant?
So Commissioner Logan, this is Ann Spangler, General Counsel. That definitely was a resolution passed in a different era. And it is something that we are actively looking at. So I would anticipate, given that we're doing a sort of a deeper dive into broadband, et cetera, that would come up for review again.
Okay. And I noticed that resolution had lots of entities, BlackRock, NOAAnet. Are we leasing to any of those entities anymore?
NOAAnet.
Okay, yep. Thank you. Any other questions, commissioners? All right. Great presentation. Thank you so much. John, anything else in our morning briefing?
Oh, great job, Chuck. Nope, that wraps it up.
Okay, we have time for public comments this morning. If you'd like to provide public comment, please indicate you'd like to speak by clicking raise hand in the software, or if by joining by phone, dial *9. Of course, we'll have an opportunity in the afternoon for public comment also. So I will look. I'm not seeing anyone. Give people a minute or two. Gayla Shoemake. Good morning, Gayla. Go ahead. You need to unmute yourself.
Morning. Good morning.
There you are.
Hi. I thought that you were going to be discussing a little bit more the AMI, and I just wanted to let you know that the City of Edmonds has been doing some similar kinds of research and concern about 5G, and both of them have to do with electromagnetic radiation, and that they are concerned about that, and they've been working with a variety of other cities, including Portland, because there is no known studies that show show research proving that the 5G is safe for people to have in their yards. And the city really wanted to make some restrictions on where they could put the 5G meters. And that's kind of similar to some of the questions that we were having about the AMI meters. And that they're going to be discussing it tonight. So I will listen to it tonight and see where they go. But apparently there is a court case that is now at the Supreme Court about regarding the local government's ability to regulate these facilities, because now the FCC says that local governments cannot regulate it. This was all news to me. I knew that, you know, we'd been talking about AMI and that sort of thing, and I know that 5G is similar, but I had no idea that the City of Edmonds was so concerned about it, and they will be talking about that again tonight. So I just wanted to share that with you, that is a concern. And as you know, my primary concern with AMI had to do with money, but this adds another layer to the conversation. So I will be looking at that carefully this evening to see what the city decides to come up with, and also to see what happens to that court case. Part of the court case also was, remember, part of the discussion was that they had in 1996 come up with what they thought was a safe amount of radiation. And of course, a lot has happened since 1996. And part of that court case is asking that the FCC come up with another more updated requirement for exposure to humans. So anyway, I just wanted to let you all know that I was going to be looking at that, and I will let you know what, if any, results come from that. Okay? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your comments. Is there anyone else who would like to comment this morning? I'll wait a few moments for people to raise their hand. Not seeing any new hands up. Okay, it is now exactly 11 o'clock and our meeting is recessed. The regular meeting will reconvene virtually here at 1:30 p.m.